It's time again for Health Talk on KFAR Radio. 30 minutes of healthy conversation about practical ways to improve your quality of life. Now, from the all-new White Spruce Medical, here's your host, Dr. Scott Looper.
Good afternoon, Fairbanks. Welcome to Health Talk. My name is Dr. Scott Looper. I'm your host today as we talk about health, how to get it, and how to keep it. With me today is Dr. Mauricio Reynoso. Dr. Reynoso is the medical director of the Alaska Sleep Clinic. And today we're going to be talking about the importance of sleep. Dr. Reynoso, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Looper, for having me in the show.
So I'm glad you're here because sleep is such an important problem. It's such a treatable problem, and it's such a wide ranging impact on the quality of our lives, a lot more than most people realize. So, Dr. Reynoso, why don't you start off our conversation by reviewing the importance of sleep, kind of like, you know, how it breaks down and what the repercussions of that breakdown are.
Yeah, actually, you're right. This is a very important aspect of our lives, and until recently, actually, there hasn't been relatively recently much attention paid to it. But just as a first statement, I can tell you that there's so vital the problem that there is an increased mortality, for example, in persons sleeping less than 6 hours, and also sleeping too much, more than 9 hours. But it's not only a matter of sleep time, it's also the sleep quality and regularity of the sleep. So, healthy sleep is not that simple as achieving X amount of hours. And we can talk about in more detail what are adverse consequences of having inadequate sleep, I would call it.
So what are those? Yeah, let's talk about it now.
I mean, there's the well-known fact that you become sleepy and not restored sleep the morning after. But that's, besides being the most common, is unfortunately associated many times with things that we don't appreciate, like increased motor vehicle accident for the same reason, increased obesity, you know, directly and indirectly that may get a higher risk of being obese.
Now, hold on. Let's go a little slower through these things. Let me give you some impressions on these, because I have had a bad night or sleep or two occasionally, and I remember, particularly when I was younger, that if I had a short night's sleep because I had to study or we were out doing something fun or whatever it is, that the next day I might be a little tired, but I felt pretty good. I felt like I could function okay. But I've seen research say that that's an illusion. That in fact, if you miss a night's sleep, it's equivalent to having a 3-beer buzz. You feel basically normal until, you know, somebody throws something at you and hits you in the head because you're going, duh, right? So there's a definite...
We can compensate the sleep deprivation. But for acute sleep deprivation, one nap won't do it. It takes several days to catch up with what we lost in that night. And the way that they have shown that that's the case is with some testing, you know, more precise testing and about the precision of the work, the accuracy, and that is all essentially out of normal when you miss sleep. Yeah, you're right. So it's not that obvious either.
Right. It doesn't feel the same from the inside as it appears from the outside, as is so often the case, right? So let's talk about obesity. That's a key one. I mean, lots of people have problems with sleep, and lots of people have problems with weight. What's the connection?
The connection is, in my view, now placed in the right context. So obesity is related to sleep problems, and it's both ways. And sleep problems that promote obesity. So it's the way around. Have to do with lectins. Those are hormones that, the fat releases and deal with our appetite. And even though the studies are not 100% reproducible, we have seen that definitely in clinical practice and in studies, obesity is increased by sleep deprivation only. In other terms, you eat more when you're sleep deprived. I don't know if you remember when you were arrested and have to get up in the middle of the night. I'm sure that you were hungry that night.
Yeah.
And that is very obvious. So that's one of the ways. And the other way is that the obesity may cause sleep apnea. So there are different angles of it.
So we're going to come back to sleep apnea, but let's linger on this leptin thing. So I heard this too. I read it, and I've heard it by the other speakers. So I wanted to look into what is leptins, what are they doing? What I discovered is leptins are the hormone that tells our body that you've had enough. And that when you don't get a good night's sleep, that hormone doesn't work right. Your body releases it, but your body doesn't listen to it, and it overrides it. You get what's known as leptin resistance. And so bottom line is you end up eating more. I mean, because you're hungry. And some of our listeners probably get this. You know, like in the evenings, if you had dinner, you've already had enough food today. You're sitting down, you're resting, your brain says, I'm hungry. And you think, that is just crazy. I know I'm not hungry. I've already eaten dinner. I've had plenty today. You know, be quiet. And you sit there for, you know, another 3 minutes, and then your brain says, I'm hungry. And usually you get up and you go in the kitchen, you start looking around for something, right? I don't know. Crackers maybe or something. Ice cream. There it is. Bingo. And if you don't get a good enough sleep, that's how it works. It makes you crave things. It makes you hungry inappropriately when you shouldn't be, when logic would dictate you'd be fine, and here you are looking for ice cream somewhere. I can't keep it in the house, by the way. Ice cream in the house, forget it. I'll just eat it. Solutions, don't bring it in the house. Okay, now let's talk about sleep apnea. Yeah, we got plenty of time here. I want to know about the apnea, and particularly I want to know how the apnea affects the you know, the leptin and the weight gain, and yeah, what's the connection there?
Well, in terms of specifically leptin, theoretically, the problem with this is that the studies in sleep apnea patients doesn't get a clean signal. So, in general, yes, we know that it's associated with increased hunger. It's the same thing. Anything that causes sleep deprivation, including sleep apnea, may go through a similar mechanism. So that's what I can.
So it's not anything about sleep apnea itself in particular. It's just the fact that sleep apnea gets in the way of you sleeping correctly. So in a way, actually, we skipped a step, which is what is sleep apnea? So why don't you tell us what sleep apnea is?
Yeah, it's a disorder of sleep in which there is a brief suspension of airflow. So I mean, apnea means no breathing, but no breathing that word has to be in the context of sleep apnea, obstructive sleep apnea, and sleep medicine. It's not that you don't see the patient necessarily take a breath. You can do that, and it's the less common manifestation of sleep apnea, which is central sleep apnea. So when you see somebody is actually not taking any breath, doesn't move the chest or the abdomen, and there's no air movement. But in the most common case of sleep apnea, which is obstructive sleep apnea, you see the patient moving. The abdomen move, the chest move, but you don't pass air through the nose or mouth. So that's what they call obstructive sleep apnea, which is the most common form of sleep apnea. That's what most of the people refer and they know as sleep apnea. I mean, we doctors obviously classify the apneas further into central and obstructive. But that's what the sleep apnea is. And have to be, obviously, certain technical details in terms of definition. So if that happens for at least 10 seconds, with or without low oxygen and no airflow, we call it obstructive sleep apnea. If you start getting shallow breathing, meaning less than the normal breath, and your oxygen drops by 3 or 4%, a little technical term, then you call it hypopnea. But they all pretty much encompass the same thing, and we call it, in the past we used to call obstructive hypopnea in the, sleep apnea. Nowadays we just call it obstructive sleep apnea. And most of the people, when they get a sleep apnea, they stop breathing for about 20 seconds. That's a most average. If you ask me what is the most common number, it's about 20 seconds. And then the oxygen is so variable. If you got some other medical conditions, it may go really deep down, and that by itself is another problem. For example, children, they don't have low oxygen most of the time. They have very high reserve, and they don't desaturate a lot, means lower their oxygen. So the older you get, the more desaturation you get, and the more problems you have in terms of complication. It's not only the hormones that you release when you are essentially not breathing, but also because of the low oxygen, cause a bunch of changes in the in your vessels, in your veins, in your arteries, essentially. And you can have oxidation there, and you start developing the propensity to having heart attacks, arrhythmias, even diabetes, because of the same issue. So that's the definition of obstructive sleep apnea. Again, there's another sleep apnea in case, you know, some people hear, hey, what is that central sleep apnea? In general, all comers represents about 5% the central sleep apnea. The central sleep apnea got other reasons. It may be related to diseases like heart failure, stroke, but more commonly you see that in people who use medications for pain, painkillers. That is a very prevalent reason for causing this central sleep apnea.
So is that why Michael Jackson and Prince died? Didn't they die of that problem? Do you know that?
Yeah, well, Michael Jackson died because of the propofol. That's unfortunately he got central sleep apnea. Obviously, he stopped breathing. Respiratory arrest. The one in Minnesota?
Prince.
Prince.
Same story.
So, and those are not uncommon. We see that. For that, the approach is different.
So let's go. So that's 5% of apnea. The other 95% is a more common obstructive apnea. And you mentioned that when you get obstructive apnea, and if it's severe enough, your oxygen levels go down, and that has effects on your body. You would think it would. But it's interesting that it mostly is affecting your cardiovascular system, and it'll do things where it'll damage it enough to make it more likely for you to have heart attack and stroke. And that one of the things I came across and was with a patient is that she ended up getting an irregular heartbeat. She ended up getting atrial fibrillation that would turn on and shut off and turn on and shut off. And we puzzled over this thing for quite a while until I did a sleep study and found out she had apnea, fairly severe apnea. And we treated the apnea, and the heart irregularity cleared up. You want to shed any light on that? What's the connection there?
Sure. I mean, cardiologists are, and obviously a physician in general, we are more aware of that. And actually, atrial fibrillation, sleep apnea is the main factor for risk factor, for recurrence of atrial fibrillation. The patient many times goes to fancy ablations right nowadays to have recurrence and having a second procedure and so on. So, sleep apnea is usually underlying, and as you said, it depends on this hypoxemia, that in some ways they're for whatever condition they have, either, you know, cardiac condition or thyroid condition, some other risk factor, plus the hypoxemia, they trigger that event of recurrent atrial fibrillation. So, yeah, it's one of the main risk factors. So at the point that most of the cardiologists will refer a patient for a sleep study if they had atrial fibrillation.
Yeah, she was, I mean, it was a hard case for her because she ended up having to take a blood thinner to make sure that she didn't get a clot, because that's the problem that happens with atrial fibrillation. It disrupts blood flow, and occasionally you'll get a clot in your heart. You throw that clot, now you got a stroke. But in the end, what really helped her was discovering that it was a sleep apnea, and then she got a machine. Now, normally you'd think you'd use a CPAP, but her case was advanced enough that she had to use a BiPAP. Do you care to explain the difference between the two for our listeners?
Yeah, that they are different positive airway pressure devices. So the treatment of these conditions, in general, first-line treatment, is positive airway pressure. What it means is that it's a machine that delivers air, and that flow will act as a air spleen, in the airway. So keep it open. It's like if you essentially blow up a little balloon and keep it open, and it won't collapse, because what is going on is collapsing the airway. So with a low pressure, that's called positive airway pressure. Now, we got the most basic one. It's called CPAP. Actually, the first CPAP was pretty much tried for sleep apnea. With the first CPAP mask in 1981, that was Dr. Sullivan. But if you see that mask, there are pictures in the internet. You can go and see it. It's amazing. It must have been very uncomfortable. But anyway, so CPAP is the first-line treatment for obstructive sleep apnea. Sometimes the pressure needed, depending on the compliance of the airways and the level of obstruction, you need more pressure. So those machines are only capable of certain range, but at a higher range of pressure, you essentially may not tolerate. And that's very particular of a patient. I've seen patients tolerate the very high pressures without any discomfort. But most of the patients, when they go around 15, 16 centimeter water, that's one of the units that we use. And just to put in perspective, out of 20, which is the max, I started having discomfort. So that one of the reasons why we use a different type of a machine is when we share the pressures and we got two pressures, that's what they call BiPAP. So CPAP is the initial therapy, BiPAP for those intolerant, or there's some other, if you want to not only maintain open the airway, but help the ventilation of the patient, you would use the BiPAP. Now, in between, and not to confuse people, are the famous APAP nowadays, which is called automatic positive airway pressure, which in general get an algorithm that tries to normalize the way that you breathe and make it very nice and smooth instead of all cut off by the obstruction. And that doesn't automatically within certain limits. So it's not the most sophisticated algorithm, you know, but at least you can establish, and most of the time may find the pressure that you would find in a sleep lab and maintain that pressure most of the time. So there are three basic machines, CPAP, APAP. You should, the public should consider it as equivalent, because there's not really difference. In both, if you got a CPAP pressure that you determine is the optimal one, APAP won't do anything better in general. And APAP is the one if you don't find a good CPAP pressure. And then you got the BiPAP, which is two pressures. And the only reason you would use that is because you're not tolerant to CPAP, or you need to do more than just open the airway, but ventilate the patient. But there are other more complicated machines that we have, and that we use that for other condition that is called obesity hypoventilation. Things get complicated. You may be so obese that the weight on your chest doesn't let you breathe in and out your carbon dioxide. And that is worse at night. And then your oxygen goes down because you cannot take a deep breath. Independent, and no obstruction. There's no obstruction there of the airway. There's just very shallow breathing there. And that persists. And we got special machines for that. And then we got the special machines for patients with narcotics and so on.
So how do those machines work? Do they support your chest? What do they do?
Oh, the ones that they are hybrid. It's called, for example, for the obesity hypoventilation, you can get by with BiPAP. The adaptive servo-ventilation is the other device that can help in patients with problems of, for example, narcotics, central apneas, and more complex apneas, that is another entity. So essentially, we have multiple devices that can be used for different types of sleep apneas and breathing, sleep breathing disorders. And the idea is to match the right device or treatment to the particular disorder.
So how do you figure out what the problem is and what the appropriate solution is?
Well, once you have the clinical suspicion, the gold standard test is a sleep study. And a sleep study is essentially a study where you measure, you have the ability to measure if you're sleeping, what stages are you going through, if you are breathing, as you get your oxygen up and down, your heart rate, your movements, movement of the chest, abdomen, legs. And with all that information, we analyze all the potential abnormalities, and we can determine if you have the different types of sleep disorder breathings or even leg breathings or even EEG breathing means the problems. We have sometimes cut nocturnal epilepsy. So it's a very comprehensive test.
So is this the kind of thing where somebody has to come in to the clinic to get done, or do you do it in, at someone's home?
Okay, there are different kinds. If you have only the question of obstructive sleep apnea, and you don't have like any other comorbidities, meaning atrial fibrillation, heart failure, morbidly obese, you may be suspecting hypoventilation. So if you don't have anything else, periodic movement, you could get by with doing a home sleep apnea test. That is not the gold standard. That is a test specific for obstructive sleep apnea in patients that do not have significant comorbidities. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's another way. It's not as accurate as the in-lab study, to the point that even the insurance companies, if that test is non-diagnostic, it doesn't tell us you got sleep apnea and you think the patient got sleep apnea, they tell you to do it an in-lab study. So it's not a screening test because it shouldn't be used for screening. It's a diagnostic test, but get lesser sensitivity. It may not pick up mild sleep apnea. It should pick up moderate to severe sleep apnea. And most of the times that test doesn't tell you if you really are sleeping or not. Just it tells you if you stop breathing or not.
Yeah. So, okay, so there's an advantage to getting the comprehensive test, the in clinic test, particularly if someone's very sick. That's I'm understand what you're saying. If it's somebody you look at and you think, well, it's probably sleep apnea, my wife says I snore really bad and I'm, you know, tired in the afternoons and I've been hungry and I can't stop myself snacking at night and probably it's sleep apnea, then you might be able to get by with doing the at home test. But if somebody has some other condition that is going along with it, they have some sort of heart disease or they have lung disease, if COPD, or there's something like that in addition to it, or they're obese, whatever, for sure you would be wanting to do the in the clinic test, because you, there's going to be subtle things that will not come out otherwise.
Yeah, and the other issue is that once you got this home sleep apnea test, you need to really follow and take care of. In the home sleep apnea test, you could even detect if you got central apnea. If you got central apnea, you know that that CPAP may not work for it.
Yeah.
So you have to be attentive to that and follow the patient. Be sure that the patient respond well, and so on. So that's most of the home sleep apnea tests are the recommendation by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine is that is essentially monitored by a sleep physician. You know, that's the recommendation.
So how would somebody get a test like that? Do they have to go to their primary doctor and get a referral? Can they call you guys directly? How does it work?
Yeah, I mean, both. Actually, we receive referrals from the physician because they have talked to the patient and determined that they do have concerns about sleep apnea or other sleep disorder. Or they can, you know, self-refer, and you will see, obviously, a physician there, and that will pretty much determine what is the best test for you. Your particular case, and now you can call the Alaska's Sleep Clinic in Fairbanks. The phone number over there is 907-374-3063, and you know, usual working days. And the sleep study can be done throughout the week, Saturdays and Sundays. So that some people obviously work the whole week and cannot spend, doesn't have the luxury to spend the night or get this home sleep apnea test or whatever is the order. And then there's a convenience of weekends.
So where's the, I'm just curious, where are you guys located?
No, that's an airport way, 1901 airport way. And that's the Alaska Sleep in Fairbanks.
So, Dr. Reynoso, we're out of time, but I want to tell you that I've really appreciated you taking the time and talking with us today. Clearly, you're very competent. You know what you're talking about. This is about the deepest dive we've done into sleep problems and studies and CPAPs and BiPAPs and central apnea and obstructive apnea. I mean, all these things. It's really very, very, very interesting and really very, very important to quality of life. This is a common problem, as you know, you and I well know, and lots of our listeners know that they either have the problem or know someone does. And if you can get the proper assessment to figure out what kind of sleep disorder there is and then get the appropriate treatment, it makes a world of difference in the quality of your life, your ability to have your brain think, to carry a thought, your ability to have fun and have the energy to do fun, and your ability not to slip and fall and crash and, you know, crack your head on the ice. We, you know, this is a dangerous place that we live, and if you are sleep deprived, the chance of you getting injured is much increased. So that if that wasn't, everything else we said wasn't reason enough, well, there's that one right there. So Dr. Reynoso, thank you again so much for being a guest on the show today.
All right. Thank you for having me anytime again.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. It was a real pleasure. So I want to let everybody know that Craig Compo's outdoor show is going to follow this one as usual. And I want to let you know, this has been Health Talk. I'm your host, Dr. Scott Looper, Medical Director of White Spruce Medical, located at the Steese Medical Center here in Fairbanks, where we treat gastrointestinal diseases such as diarrhea, constipation, gastritis, stuff like that. I want everybody to stay safe, stay healthy, and stay in touch.
You've been listening to Health Talk on KFAR Radio, brought to you by White Spruce Medical in the Steese Medical Center. To listen back to this or any past programs, simply log on to KFARradio.com and go to the archives page for more Health Talk. Local stories, local programs, local news, local talk radio. We are KFAR.